really crisp playing there by Maria João Pires in Mozart, the piano sonata in F major, Kirkel 280. And that's just about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. Thank you so much for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed listening. Next week, my chosen rare symphony is by Henri Dutilleux, his first, where the conductor is Daniel Barenboim. And the Beethoven violin sonata that I'm featuring might be described as the pastoral of the cycle. Certainly, as far as the sun-drenched slow movement is concerned, it's number 6 in A, played by Anne-Sophie Mutter with Lambert Orcus at the piano, a very lively musical partnership. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
The City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra performs Richard Strauss's extraordinary Sinfonia Domestica, a no-holds-barred musical diary of a day with the Strauss family, from a morning lion to bath time for baby. And in the first half, two works inspired by Shakespeare, a new song cycle by Hans Abrahamsson, and Mendelssohn's enchanting overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Join me, Ian Skelly, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and Andras Nelsons for Live in Concert this Wednesday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, or listen in high-definition sound on the Radio 3 website.
Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3, and now it's just turned midday and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest today is the Holocaust survivor Eva Schloss.
Eva Schloss was born into a happy middle-class Jewish family in Vienna in 1929, but her childhood came to an abrupt end when she was 9 and had to flee with her parents and older brother to escape the Nazis. Before going into hiding in Amsterdam, Eva's family befriended Anne Frank's, and after the war, the Frank legacy was to play a large part in her life. Like the Franks, Eva's family was betrayed, and she and her mother were captured by the Gestapo on her 15th birthday and transported to the Birkenau concentration camp. They were two of only a few prisoners still alive when the camp was liberated in January 1945. Her brother and father did not survive the neighbouring camp of Auschwitz. Somehow, Eva learnt to live alongside the memory of those terrible years, and after the war, rebuilt her life in England. Now, in her 80s, she tours the world, spreading her message of reconciliation and hope. And in 2012, she received an MBE for her work with the Anne Frank Trust and other Holocaust charities. Your family, Eva, was very musical. And of course, one thinks of Vienna, especially pre-war Vienna, as quintessentially musical, doesn't one?
Oh, definitely, yes. People used to go to cafes, and wherever you went, there was music, the Austrian music, Strauss, of course, particularly.
And lots of making music, too.
Making music, a lot of people played music, and people went regularly to concert, little, not just big concert hall, but in small homes as well. A lot of chamber music, so everybody just played, not always best quality, but it didn't matter. It was just to express yourself in music and listen to it. That was really part of Vienna.
And, of course, your own family.
Yes, that was very, very important. I remember me sitting on my grandfather's lap when he played, and I just played with my finger, you know, certain little tunes. But it was, we were growing up with music.
The first piece that you've chosen, I think, reminds you particularly of this childhood in Vienna. And I think it was also used in a rather special way by the family, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. As soon as I and my brother learned to whistle, we were told that we have a family tune. So ever if you are somewhere outside and you are lost or whatever, whistle. And that is the only thing I can do is And I have told my children, and they have told their children, so it is still a family whistle. And if we are in a supermarket and are in a different island, we can't find each other, this is what we whistle.
And, of course, during the war, I think it was used quite often by
the
broadcasters.
BBC, yeah. The BBC, the Dutch programme to the occupied country, and I know I remember it very, very clearly. It started at 9 o'clock. This is the BBC from London, and it started with da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. And we were glued to the radio, which we were not allowed to listen, of course, to foreign broadcast. And we heard the news, some terrible, about Auschwitz with the gassing. We heard that from the BBC. But as well, the progress they made in the war. So that gave us hope that the war would end soon. But it was a long, long haul, 6 years.
We heard Ricardo Chailly conducting the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig in the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Isn't it extraordinary that that piece, which has such symbolism for you, but also that it came to be the iconic representation of resistance, and yet was by an Austro-German composer?
Well, art should be really international. And this is what there were a lot of disputes about. Wagner should the orchestra in Tel Aviv, if they should play Wagner. And so, you know, the terrible things that the Germans burned books by Jewish writers, which, you know, literature, music should be international, and it shouldn't matter if the people were Jewish or Christian or black or white or whatever. It is just an expression of their feeling, and it should be appreciated by everybody.
You clearly adored your brother, Heinz, and he was very artistic and musical, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so, yes.
What instruments did he play?
Well, if there was a piano, of course, piano was his first love. But later he got an accordion, which he played very, very well, and of course a guitar, but as well an instrument which I have never seen or heard since was a Hawaiian guitar. I don't know, he found it somewhere and he played it, and it was a very exotic instrument, exactly, and he just loved it. And then the banjo, he had borrowed very often a banjo, and he loved George Formby. Everything which was a bit different he liked, and very challenges. He liked to play things which were very difficult. Like, of course, what we are coming to is Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue. It's a very, very difficult piece of music. And he just wanted to get perfect in it, so he practiced it a lot. So I heard a lot of it, so I started to love it as well. And it's something which is became very, very dear in our family.
Thank you.
You're quite right, Eva Schloss, to say that it's difficult in places, because all the main tunes, they're quite straightforward, but it's all the filigree work in between,
exactly,
isn't it?
And Hans was just 14 years old when he played this. So really quite unbelievable talent. And he didn't have to look at the music. At first, of course, yes, but then he could just play it. He had a perfect ear.
And, of course, Bernstein, who was playing there, was absolutely, just like, I think, probably your brother, very ambidextrous. He could play and he could conduct and, of course, he could compose. And he had that wonderful American ability to sort of play lazy, to improvise and to stretch the music across the bar. We heard him there conducting the Columbia Symphony Orchestra from the piano in the opening of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Eva, your family left Vienna in the spring of 1938 and eventually settled in Amsterdam, where you met the Frank family. And Anne, I think, was the same age as you.
Exactly, yes, yes.
How
this
do you
year
remember
she would
her
have
now?
Been 85, yeah. Like me.
What are your memories now of her?
You know, with 11 years old, she wasn't famous. She was just one of my playmates. Mm. And very often I have asked the question, what was the last conversation you had with her? I said, do you want me to make up something? You know, I would definitely not know what I talked with her 70 years ago. But she was not my best friend because I was a tomboy. I was quite a wild child. And she was quite a sophisticated little girl, interested in film stars, in her hair and her clothes, which I wasn't. But nevertheless, you know, children came out to play after school and we skipped together and did hopscotch and all the things which little 11-year-old kids do. And I kind of looked up to her because she was definitely more advanced. My mother always said, you are a late developer. She was quite sure of herself. She left Germany when she was 4 years old, so she hadn't experienced the persecution which I had experienced in Austria. And then as well in Belgium, where we were Jewish refugees, we were not really wanted there. So I became quite subdued, and she was quite open and always told stories, always wanted a big crowd in front of her. So, you know, quite a different life than I had at the time.
Music was part of your life in Amsterdam even then, because I think your mother played the piano.
My mother played as well, yes.
And somebody but would come
music,
and play the violin with her?
Yes, yes.
A non-Jewish person?
Yes. Yeah. He came and we had, because Jewish people had to be in at 8 o'clock, so they did sort of chamber music together. Mm. Nobody in our family played violin, but it goes to your feeling, I think. It can really go right down to your heart. I love most violin concertos, but Mendelssohn and Bach's Bruch, those are the ones I really love. And again, I think, you know, it's an emotion which it brings out.
Let's hear the beginning of the Mendelssohn violin concerto.
Thank you.
There is something, Eva Schloss, isn't there, about a solo violin, which is almost like a human voice, sort of goes straight to the soul.
It certainly does. And, of course, Bernard Haitink, the Dutch conductor, of course, Amsterdam Concertgebouw, he was, of course, wonderful conductor. And after the war, I quite often went to the Concertgebouw.
And there, the soloist was Itzhak Perlman. So there's another nice connection.
That's another connection, exactly.
And that was the start of the first movement of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor. In the summer of 1942, you and your family in Amsterdam were forced to disappear into hiding. But then the family was betrayed and the Gestapo came for you and your mother on your 15th birthday, the 11th of May, 1944.
Yeah, that's true. We were betrayed by a Dutch nurse who was a double agent. She pretended she worked for the resistance, but she really was a Nazi and helped the Nazis. And, you know, the Dutch didn't have the... After the war, everybody saw, partly through Anne's story, everybody thought the Dutch were so wonderful. They were, of course, wonderful people, but as well, there were quite a lot of Nazis. And actually from Holland, in proportion, more Jews were deported than in any other occupied country, which wasn't always known. And there was a huge group of people who betrayed Jewish people, partly out of conviction, but as well for money.
I found your book after Auschwitz extremely moving, detailing what it was like to be in Birkenau. It's very hard for those of us that have not been through something like that to know how on earth one actually does get over it. Do you think perhaps the tomboyish, you know, resilience in you helped quite a bit?
Oh, definitely. And as well, I was a very stubborn child, and still am, my family will say. And that certainly did help. And, you know, I really wanted to experience life. I was 15 when I was in Auschwitz. I had not really experienced having a boyfriend, not a family, my own children. And I really wanted to have that. So I never, ever gave up.
I suppose you've developed quite a canny sense of survival.
Yes, I suppose so. But, you know, very often people say, have you ever done anything in the camp which you are sorry about? You know, but people did steal things from other people and things like that. And I must say, no, I haven't. I feel not guilty about anything like that. And that's a great relief. And again, you know, I am very pleased I survived. Through my own strengths, but as well through luck. There was a lot in the camps, there was a lot of luck which helped you again to live through the next day.
How about the thing that's often written about, which is the guilt of surviving? Or maybe that eluded you?
Well, I think that happens more, first of all, if people survived through harming other people, which did happen, of course. And then I think if parents survive their children, that is something which never should happen. I think that was the worst part which happened to me in the camp. My mother was selected to be guest, but through a miracle she came back to the living. And she writes in my, not in this book, in another book, she writes, she accepted that she would die. She was 40 years old, but she prayed that her children would survive. I suppose when she survived and not her son, she felt guilty about that.
I imagine it must be quite poignant for you listening to our next piece, Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder, Songs on the Death of Children, since they are settings of Rückert's poems about the death of his children. So it must, in a way, this music must have a kind of particular resonance for you.
You know, children, Totenlieder, it's a very, very sad kind of music. And so when I hear his music, I always get back to the death camp, the terrible things which happened. And, you know, children had no chance to survive. beautiful recording and wonderful voice as well. Huh?
It's unbearably moving.
It is, I know.
And it was only, I think, a few years after that that Mahler lost his daughter to scarlet fever. Yeah. And I think he often felt that he was somehow tempting fate in some strange way. Janet Baker, singing wonderfully the first of Mahler's Kinder Totenlieder, Songs on the Death of Children, with John Barbirolli conducting the Halle Orchestra. You and your mother had some pretty difficult times after the war, but you lived back in Amsterdam, presumably hoping, almost against hope, that your father and brother might somehow have survived?
You know, one doesn't know much about this, but it did happen, and not just a single case. Many, many people came back after 45, of course. We came back then, but there were people who came back in 48 and 49. Very, very often people turned up after many, many years. And my father was such a strong person, and I thought, well, if I have survived, how could he not have survived? And that made it, of course, much more difficult to accept that they will never come back.
However, there was one person who came back into your life after the war, and that was Otto Frank.
He, who had lost everything, was still an optimist, and I was full of hatred, and he said, you know, you can't go through your life hating. I don't hate. And he had no hatred, not even against the Nazis. And that is something I couldn't comprehend for many, many, many years.
Perhaps he felt that bitterness, in a sense, ends up chewing the person that's feeling bitter rather than accomplishing anything else.
That's what he said to me. The people you hate don't know, but you will be a miserable person. So he helped me a lot, and he became very, very close to my mother, and they helped each other to make a new life again. And in 1953, they got married, and I've never experienced a happier marriage between those two people. They really understood each other. And Otto very often said, I could never have married a person who hasn't gone through the same experience and lost her own child as well.
And I think Otto got you interested in photography, which got you your first job, didn't he?
Correct, yes. Yeah. After I finished school, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was still very miserable in Amsterdam. And he and my mother had decided I should become a photographer. I was quite artistic. And he gave me his Leica, because he was a very keen photographer. Not artistically, but his family. His family was for him very, very important. And he took hundreds of pictures of his children wherever they were. Yeah, he really helped me, and my children didn't have another grandfather, so we had to gain a family.
Yes, because you eventually moved to London, where you met your husband, Zvi, and had a happy life together, three children, as you say, and running an antique shop.
I travelled around the country, and in the 70s you could find wonderful things still, and business was really great. My father was a very good businessman, and my mother always said, you have inherited this business talent of your father, and I really enjoyed it.
And the next piece, which is completely unlike everything else we've had, and partially because it comes from a very nice, happy time when your children became teenagers.
That's correct, yes. And that was really quite amazing. My oldest daughter, when I think she was about 15, she liked Jackson 5, which was coming up, the music, and she started a Jackson 5 fan club. And Michael was 5, 6 years old, was gorgeous, and she...
She met them at Heathrow, didn't she, and
yes,
escorted
yes,
them to
their gigs. Yes, yes, she became the representative of them here, actually, in London, in England, and she had to go to Heathrow, pick them up, take them to their hotel, and she was with them all the time, the few days they were here in London. But it was for her, I think, quite a amazing. And we still have scrapbooks which he collected at the time. So it was quite jolly. And of course, never suspecting how Michael would become really the most famous of the whole group.
What shall we hear them performing?
ABC.
Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 with ABC. And just in case that's not in your record collection, you can find details of the music on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. When you moved to England, Eva Schloss, you were reunited with your grandparents who had fled here before the war. And I think, didn't your grandfather play the piano in Lancashire in various venues?
Yes, that's another quite funny story. He didn't really learn English very well, and he was quite lonely up there in Darwin, tiny little town. And in the evening, he went to the pub, and he liked his beer. It was used in Vienna as well. And in some pubs, there was a old piano. So he just went there and started to play. And during the war, of course, people were quite depressed. So the women who, the men were in the army or so, came to stand around the piano and said, "Can you play this? Can you play that?" And they sang it, and he could again just play it. And so he became the most popular man in the town. Everybody tried to get him into their pub if there was a piano. And so
into the working men's clubs as well.
Exactly, yes. And so he was quite happy. He knew in the evening he had somewhere to go and he would be popular and people would treat him to some beer. And he liked the ladies as well. So it was, you know, it cheered up his emigration and the refugee status, which was very, very difficult for older person to accept, really.
So it's quite interesting. All your family, whether we're talking about your daughter in the Jackson Five or your grandfather, have used their kind of gifts in a way to actually make life more bearable and to get on in life.
Yes, definitely. Yes, yes.
Well, but, talking about talent, I think the soloist in our next concerto was a remarkable player, but also one stricken with tragic.
Yes. Well, Otto's cousin, Millie Stanfield, lived in England. She was the one who wrote at the beginning of the war to Otto, "Send us your two girls and we will keep them safe while the war is on." And Otto and his wife discussed it and wrote, "Thank you very much for the offer, but life without our children would be meaningless." And very often after the war, he said, "If only I hadn't been so self-centered and wanting my children with us, they would still be alive." And she, Millie Stanfield, was a cello player. She had a cello school here in London, and she played with Pablo Casals and knew him quite well. And I started to be interested in that instrument. And then when I heard Jacqueline Dupré playing, I loved her music. Then I started to read her book about her life later and her tragic life.
I mean, for a cellist, multiple sclerosis is the most cruel thing, because it's a very gradual diminution of your powers of control.
Exactly, exactly.
I'm rather glad you've chosen not the Elgar, which we tend to have very often, because it's so associated with her in that Barbara Raleigh performance. But you've chosen the Schumann, which is a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
Why? What does it say to you?
Well, that's again, you know, Austrian, continental composer. And that's something, you know, it's in me. And the culture, the music which you have heard, which was always around us. And so that's why I like Schumann and Schubert and all those, and the songs and this music.
And of course, Schumann was no stranger to emotional and psychological difficulties. Throughout his life, he was very troubled at times, particularly towards the end of his life. And it informed his music, I think. Jacqueline Dupré, with the new Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, in the opening of the first movement of the Schumann Cello Concerto in A minor. Eva Schloss, you have done a great deal for the Anne Frank Trust, and you've done a lot to talk about these very difficult experiences in the hope of actually making the world a better place, I suppose. I'm sure you wouldn't put it in such portentous terms, but you know what I mean.
Well, of course, yes. We must not give up. We must have hopes that eventually people will come to their senses and realize that living in harmony together is better for everybody, really.
Eva, you seem now to be very positive, very forward-looking, and astonishingly lacking in bitterness. Perhaps it wasn't always like that.
Oh, definitely not. For many, many, many years, I resented everything, everybody's, not just the Germans, but the whole world, because it could have been avoided. But, you know, I used to be in Vienna a very happy child, and I really wanted to go back to my own character and to my own nature. And so I struggled for many, many, many years, and I succeeded to become a happy person, an optimistic person, and realizing it only harms you if you hate people. And now really I've accepted what has happened, and we just have to move on.
Well, we're going to go back to Vienna for the last piece.
It makes me sad that I had to give up this culture, the life which we had in Austria. But the music really speaks to me. You know, basically, if you're born, and my family has lived there for generations, Middle European, that is in your blood. It's, you can't just shake it off.
Well, to the tones and rhythms of Strauss's Wiener Blut, Eva Schloss, can I thank you very much for sharing your private passions with us?
It's been a pleasure.
Herbert von Karajan conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in Strauss's Wiener Blutwaltz, ending that edition of Private Passions. And details of Eva Schloss's musical choices are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, where you can also download a free podcast of the programme. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest will be the musician Hugh Masekela. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through proceedings on Radio 3 this afternoon. In a moment, Pascal Roget plays an all-French programme of piano music in our lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall. Then at 2 o'clock, we take a trip around the Russell Collection of Early Keyboard Instruments in Edinburgh to hear the music of Rameau played on 3 double-manual French harpsichords made in the late 1700s that have been fully restored to playing condition. Sophie Yates tries them out in an hour from now. But with the time at 1 o'clock, a summary of the BBC News this lunchtime. The former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who sent British troops to Iraq, has denied the American-led invasion of 2003 has contributed to the recent upsurge in violence there. He said Britain had to engage with what was happening, as the prospect of returning jihadist fighters was a worry. Reports from Iraq suggest that government forces and Shia militias are holding back an advance by Sunni militants north of Baghdad. Pakistan says the man suspected of planning the attack on Karachi airport a week ago has been killed in an airstrike. Abu Abdul Rahman al-Mani led militants from Uzbekistan who've been fighting alongside the Taliban. He was among more than 50 people killed in the military operation in a tribal region close to the border with Afghanistan. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accused the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas of being behind the disappearance of 3 teenagers in the West Bank on Thursday. About 80 Palestinians were arrested overnight by Israeli security forces around the city of Hebron. A senior Hamas official in Gaza has dismissed Mr. Netanyahu's claims of Hamas involvement in the abductions as silly. The Culture Secretary, Sajid Javid, has said that the vast majority of Muslims in the UK exhibited British values of tolerance and respect, but a small minority were spoiling it for everyone else. He was speaking after David Cameron repeated a call to teach British values in schools. A man has been charged with the murder of a woman who was found dead at her home in Martlesham Heath in Suffolk. The body of Jane Bartholomew, who was 39, was discovered by police on Friday night. She had significant head injuries. Scott Ellis, who's 42 and from Tunstall Green, will appear in court tomorrow. A service has been held at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire to unveil a sculpture dedicated to past, present and future Navy personnel. The Naval Service Memorial is made up of several coloured glass panels designed to cast a shadow in the shape of a warship and the figure of a lone sailor whose head is bowed in respect. The weather for this afternoon, southern Scotland and northern England will have light showers, but most places will be dry with bright or sunny intervals. And that's the BBC News, the time 3 minutes past one. Next on Radio 3, the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert, and a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. It was introduced by Sarah Walker.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall. In today's concert, we have 3 French masterpieces from the early 20th century, played by a pianist who couldn't be more closely associated with this repertoire, the Parisian-born Pascal Roget. 2 of these works will be familiar to many music lovers, Debussy's Suite Bergamasque and Ravel's Sonatine, while the final piece, Poulenc's Soirée de Nazelles, is less well known. Poulenc himself condemned it, but it proved to be extremely popular with pianists, and it's acknowledged as his most important work for the piano. But Pascal Roget will begin his recital with Debussy and the Suite Bergamasque. It was written in 1890 and inhabits the world of Verlaine's Fêtes Galantes with its Commedia dell'arte figures, which was so popular in 18th century Paris. There are 4 movements, a stirring prelude, a quirky but very elegant minuet, and then comes the most celebrated piece of the suite, Clair de Lune, with its pensive opening, leading to more passionate material later on, and always with the most sonorous piano textures. And the final movement is a passe-pied with a very rhythmic accompaniment, bouncing away beneath an expressive melody. And here comes Pascal Roget onto the stage at Wigmore Hall to perform the Suite Bergamasque by Debussy. Thank you.